You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. He got his MTV. Tom Freston helped birth MTV and reinvent television. In an excerpt from his new memoir, Unplugged, Adventures from MTV to Timbuktu, he recalls the campaign that saved the network. By the summer of 1982, MTV was in desperate straits. We were still big in Oklahoma, but few other cable companies were adding MTV to their lineups. In American business, if you ain't growing, you're dying. We were in danger of being shut down if we couldn't convince more cable guys to carry us before the money ran out. Enter George Lois and Dale Pond, a wild-eyed, smiling, but scary-looking dude whose specialty was media promotion, which involved banging people over the head repeatedly with a simple idea, such as love songs, nothing but love songs, WPIX-FM. Years earlier, Lois had overseen an ad campaign for an oatmeal brand that enlisted Mickey Mantle and Wilt Chamberlain to cry on camera and whine, "I want my Mapo." It was ironic, it was satiric, it was bold, it was ridiculous. It was advertising that became more famous than the product. Pond and Lois were hired to help us beat the Reaper. "Let's rip off my old Mapo campaign," Lois said. "I want my MTV. F these cable guys. You got to go for broke." Being solicitous of the cable operators had gotten us nowhere. The next step was to get legions of spoiled young adult baby boomers to demand their MTV, just like they had once demanded their Mapo. So was born the campaign, "I Want My MTV." Now we had to identify which stars were the rock and roll equivalents of Mickey Mantle and Wilt the Stilt. Lois answered that immediately. "You need to get Mick Jagger. He's the biggest star in the world." "Sure, George. No problem." We had learned some lessons about big stars and MTV. Early on, we had struggled to get permission even to use photos of recording artists. My partner, John Sykes, and I realized we were asking the wrong people. To the record labels, we might as well have been a high school fan club asking for free pictures. They were oriented toward radio and print, not TV. It was worse when we tried to go through the lawyers. They said no as a policy. It seemed to defy logic, but we found that the easiest people to deal with were the hardest people to get to, the artists themselves. We went off like bounty hunters to bag our targets. Sykes's mission was Pete Townsend. Les Garland, our hilarious new larger-than-life head of programming, went for Mick Jagger, whom he had met before. I drew David Bowie. This was our Hail Mary shot. Next photos, Starman. In the early 1980s, MTV struggled to break into even mid-sized cable markets. Then it landed David Bowie and Mick Jagger and Pete Townsend for a watershed ad campaign. Sykes waited for hours outside Townsend's manager's London office. When Townsend showed up, Sykes went into his boyish charismatic mode. "Hi, Pete. I'm John Sykes. I'm with MTV. It's a new channel that plays music videos. Would you do a promo for us like you do when you visit radio stations?" Townsend probably assumed his manager had set this up. He asked Sykes when he wanted to do it. "How about right now?" Pond had rented a garage across the street and had his camera set up. Sykes led Townsend over. It took only a few minutes. Garland took Pond and a video crew to Paris to stalk the Rolling Stone. When he finally appeared, Garland was on him with the full hustle of a seasoned radio veteran. Jagger remembered him. All you need to say is, I want my MTV, Garland said. You want me to do a commercial, said Jagger. It's really more of an endorsement for a new phenomenon called music videos. Yeah, that's a commercial. The Rolling Stones don't do commercials. Mick, we don't have any money, but if this is about money, I'll give you a dollar. Garland laid a dollar on the table. It could have gone either way, but Jagger laughed. Then he said, I like you, Garland. I'll do it. Jagger told them to come back the next day. They did. He gave them 5 minutes, during which he said, I want my MTV a few times, giving it the weight of I can't get no satisfaction. Bowie had a very pleasant, somewhat mysterious associate named Coco Schwab. Managers came and went. Record labels came and went. But Schwab was a constant. I called her. Would David be willing to do an I Want My MTV commercial? She responded a day later. He'd really love to, but David's skiing in Gstaad in Switzerland right now. He's on vacation. He'll do it on skis on the slopes there if you want. Are you up for a little trip? It'll be fun. Was I up for that little trip? We were operating like Mission Impossible. Along with Pond and his crew, I took a plane to Zurich, then a train, and wound through the snowy Alps to posh Gstaad with a full load, of heavy 35mm gear. Schwab had us carry everything out into the snow and set up at the bottom of a remote hill. Bowie skied down in great spirits. He was in his slick Let's Dance phase. On the slopes, he looked like a surfer with blonde hair, dressed in a slim parka and shades. He directed himself for the spot. He wanted to ski down, swoosh at the bottom, rip off his sunglasses, and with a broad grin, say, I want my MTV. He thought it would be fun to put our logo on his skis, too, in post-production. We got the spot in a few takes. Mission accomplished. When we finished, Bowie asked if any of us wanted to ski with him. I am rarely starstruck by artists. Bowie, though. Bowie and the Beatles had a special aura for me, head and shoulders over everyone else. Bowie made it easy in the Alps. He talked about books more than music. He asked about my background. I got some laughs out of him. I knew a girl who worked for him who dated my brother. That was another icebreaker. Later, when the sun was dropping, Bowie said, Hey, Tom, how about a sauna later to relax, top off the day? Come meet me at the Palace Hotel. The Gstaad Palace was the epicenter of Gstaad High Society, the towering 5-star Grand Dame Hotel in the valley. I rushed back to our hotel, a Spartan lodge, barely a cut above a youth hostel. You're not going to believe this, but Bowie just invited me to take a sauna with him at the Palace Hotel. See you losers later, I told the crew. Bowie was waiting in the spa. We walked together into the sauna. There was only one other person there. He was sitting on a high bench up in the back, deep in the fog. I squinted. It was Paul McCartney. Jesus Christ. Somehow I'd made it into the sauna of the stars. Bowie and McCartney and Tommy Freston from Connecticut sat around naked, wrapped in towels, taking turns throwing water on the hot rocks. We shot the shit for half an hour. They were easy to talk to and eager to hear about MTV. I was full of gratitude. Jagger's in, we told Pat Benatar. That was all she needed to know. Same with the police. Our storyboard had Sting swinging a telephone receiver around like a madman, almost jumping off the screen and shouting, America, call your cable company and demand your MTV. I helped round up Billy Idol, Cyndi Lauper, Holland Oates, and others. I traveled with Pon and his camera crew all over the world. After a while, artists were calling us, asking to be in the spots. I want my MTV became one of the most effective ad campaigns of all time. It saved us. It transformed us. After a 3-week barrage, without fail, each cable operator in a market we targeted raised a white flag and signed up. We added more than 1 million new homes every month for more than 2 years. I had a map in the office to help us plot our next attack. In the end, we closed in on the 2 major media markets, New York and Los Angeles. This was where the influencers, the opinion makers, the critics, the advertising agencies, the magazine editors, and most importantly, our employees lived. In rock and roll, it takes a long time and a lot of work to become an overnight sensation. All of America got its MTV, then the entire world got it. This article was excerpted from Unplugged, Adventures from MTV to Timbuktu by Tom Freston. Copyright 2025 by Tom Freston. Reprinted by permission of Gallery Books. An imprint of Simon & Schuster. realm of the coin in a financial system upended by cryptocurrencies and meme stocks, where value is detached from utility and the loudest voice gets richest, Zoe Bernard tours a brave new world in Bel Air that is part Bravo Celebrity, part Wolf of Wall Street, and all casino, with photographs by Michelle Grosskopf. Opening photo, the meme generation, chasing the jackpot, or planning the next party by the pool at Meme House LA, where two internet species, meme coin traders and influencers, come together. On a recent afternoon, in otherwise sleepy Bel Air, where multi-million dollar mansions disappear behind walls of tangled bougainvillea, two security guards, handguns at their hips, pace before a tall black gate, keeping watch over a cutting-edge social experiment, the marriage of influencer culture and meme coin speculation. Inside, caterers pass out coconuts to Love Island cast members who lounge in glittering bikinis, prepping to film sponsored content. Everyone is beautiful, bronzed, and carefully composed for the camera. At the head of a long table sits Jade Watson, a red-headed content producer, drafting a Prediction Markets for Dummies campaign based on the long-term romantic prospects of the reality show's couples. Buy, hold, or sell. What we're doing is simplifying trading terms, Watson says, but we're using the language Gen Z already speaks. Downstairs, in a room of wall-to-wall windows overlooking dusty canyons, sloping out to the Los Angeles skyline, four traders sit before massive monitors. The screens are filled with charts and numbers. It looks like a tiny Wall Street trading floor with a patio bar and infinity pool attached. Webcams are fixed on the traders, live streaming to an invisible online audience. There's a DJ. Welcome to Meme House, LA. While the reality stars upstairs possess the hyper-real beauty bestowed by an Instagram filter, these traders look like regular people. But they, too, are participants in a reality show, a 24/7 live stream about themselves. The meme coin traders live in a mansion that reportedly sold 2 years back for some $18 million. The goal of the project is to turn each of these traders into what is called a KOL, or key opinion leader, an influencer who moves markets. One of the most famous KOLs was Roaring Kitty, the redhead band-wearing YouTuber who made millions rallying his followers, like Reddit's R Wall Street Bets, to invest in GameStop. What I want, says Roman Hossein, the project's elusive founder, surveying the scene, is to create 8 Roaring Kitties. Hossein is dressed in the costume of California comfort. Bare feet, peeking out beneath white jeans, a tan polo spun from natural-looking fiber, and on his wrist a Rolex. Hossein says he made his fortune in cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Out in the driveway sit two Lamborghinis, a Ferrari F8 Tributo, and a Rolls-Royce. Everyone always says, I wish I got into Bitcoin back in the day when everyone was making money, states Hossein, but with meme coins, we see those kinds of returns every single week. Meme House LA and its occupants represent one of the stranger phenomena of the post-pandemic internet, the emergence of a financial ecosystem cobbled together from Telegram group chats, Discord channels, and Twitter DMs, where millions are made and lost by people who in a previous era would have had little access to or interest in the markets. It is all centered on an asset that has no clear function or utility, but it is powered by the most valuable tinder on the planet, attention. With Meme House LA, Hossein is cross-pollinating two internet species, meme coin traders and influencers, who socialize at extravagant parties featuring celebrity guests, fire dancers, and catering from Nobu. The celebrities and influencers deliver the audience. The meme coin traders provide the education, teaching young people how to make millions betting on just about everything, from their favorite Love Island couple to the enduring popularity of Labubus. If all goes according to plan, the Bel Air Mansion will be Hossein's first outpost in a network catering to this emerging audience. Meme House LA may become Meme House Miami or Meme House Dubai, he says. But for this project to take off, it needs the same brand of oxygen that everything online demands. Right now, we want eyeballs, Hossein says. We need eyeballs. Back in January, it felt like everyone was about to get really, really rich. We are in for face-melting growth. Alex Taub, the founder of the fantasy IP brand Goblin Town, who has long dabbled in cryptocurrencies, tells me at the time. This is the 1990s stock market. A monkey could throw a dart at a wall of stocks and make money. And it only seemed destined to continue. The incoming president was not only crypto-friendly, he had plans to mint his own meme coin. So did the president's wife. In September, when World Liberty Financial, a crypto venture led by the president and his three sons, launched a new coin, the family's holdings surpassed $5 billion on paper. The running joke, says Taub, goes like this. You have the next 4 years to retire your entire bloodline. From the outside, it all looked too stupid to take off. Cartoon avatars shilling fart coins as a kind of currency. Bettors waging millions on whether or not a politician would wear a suit. Financial markets have always been something of a game, but they were a game for smart people, like chess. These new financial games were simpler, demanding all the intellectual rigor of Candy Crush. Being stupid actually was good. The dumber you are, the more money you make, says Taub. Still, it seemed far-fetched that these games might constitute any kind of economic viability. This is one of the largest wealth creation events for young people in history, says Zara, a 28-year-old crypto trader who lives on a cannabis farm in Northern California that she and her partner bought with their crypto winnings. Just how much money is churning through these markets is difficult to say, but in the past year, an insulated online economy has risen from a thicket of wallets and exchanges where fortunes are won and lost within a matter of minutes. On a Sunday in early August, when crypto markets were down, the leaderboard of a crypto wallet tracking website called Coalscan was topped by Payne, the trader who as of that day had made just over $60,000 trading meme coins. But this was nothing compared to Cupsy, a figure of legend in the world of meme coin traders, who, according to the site, had netted $1.5 million in a month. Bouts of crazed, crypto-stoked frenzy have happened before, including with NFTs, and before that, ICOs. Both of those have largely fizzled out. But the formerly clunky tech powering the creation of new kinds of money has gotten faster, slicker. Now anyone can create a meme coin from their laptop without even a cursory understanding of a blockchain. Millions more could buy it. Sending a payment in cryptocurrency is about as challenging as ordering a t-shirt off Amazon. These markets are fueled in part by the uneasy sense that the entire economy is imploding from the inside out. Sure, things look good according to the stock market, but on the ground, it feels bleak. These days, a normal job can only get you so far, and the average salary can't get you anything that really matters. Certainly not a house, and probably not your medical treatments, child care, or college. There's a feeling that if you don't dip your toe in the game, you may not be able to afford an apartment in the future, a communications advisor at a cryptocurrency-focused venture firm tells me. These kids and their gambling, it won't end well. The financial establishment will realize that this isn't about gambling or degeneracy. It's about so much more than that. What it's about exactly is not readily apparent from the Meme House LA trading floor, where the prospective key opinion leaders are clicking furiously between screens of rising and falling numbers. This is, in meme coin parlance, what's called the trenches. The top trader at Meme House LA is Sonny. He is middle-aged, raspy-voiced, and heavily tattooed. $100 bills circle his forearm, snaking up toward his biceps. On X, he sometimes posts about how meme coins changed his life. "I was told after prison I would never amount to anything. The trenches changed that." Hashtag trap to trenches, reads a recent tweet. Along with the text is a photo, a stack of 20s fanned across a keyboard with the words computer money. Sonny is monitoring a trade of a meme coin called Honk, which bears a cartoon goose holding a bat. Sonny hopes the goose will catch on, and he'll multiply his initial investment of roughly one Solana, which, on this day, is worth around $160. So far, he's lost $30, but things could reverse in minutes. Part of meme coin's broad appeal is that it doesn't take much cash to get started. A typical coin launches at fractions of a cent. Catch one before it hits mainstream, and you stand to multiply your money many times over. Sonny is still reeling from another missed opportunity. "Just wait until I show you how I effed this up," he says, opening the chart for a meme coin that's a cartoon cat dressed in a fedora and a trench. Initially, he'd invested $80 when the market cap was $13,000. When the market dropped to $8,000, he pulled out. But hours later, the cat and the fedora had skyrocketed to a market cap of $600,000. Had he stayed in the trade a little longer, he would have made, he calculates the math on his phone, $3,846 off $80. Sonny got into meme coins in November when a guy he knows who racked up millions running a weed distribution center, everything legal, quit cold turkey to focus on trading meme coins full time. The guy introduced him to a group chat, and Sonny locked himself in his house for days and studied. Soon after, Sonny quit his job as a personal trainer to dedicate himself to trading. "Then I sat around starting getting chubby," he says, rubbing his belly. There are all kinds of names for what to call the new online economy of speculation: meme stocks and meme trading, attention economy, lottery economy, casino economy, the tokenization of everything, the financialization of everything. But my favorite is from an essay by an investor who writes under the byline Thickethot on Substack. Thickethot calls it the jackpot age, an era in which just about everyone believes that with the right amount of risk and luck, they too can get stupid rich. There is a survivor bias in crypto, where the winners are the ones telling the story, says Andy Folio, a videographer who spends some 18 hours a day leverage trading cryptocurrencies. Same with the entertainment industry. The winners are the ones on stage telling you to chase your dreams. The gamblers on Twitter are like, "Don't stop clicking." Kids these days feel the only way to make it is through gambling. In November, I was drawn to the irresistible lure myself during a visit to my hairdresser. Over a head of highlights, he told me in great detail about all the coins he'd been buying. He had parked some $200,000 in a cryptocurrency that everyone was talking about at the time, as well as tens of thousands more in a popular meme coin. He had done all this on the advice of one of his clients, a guy who, according to my hairdresser, had made identical trades. This guy, my hairdresser said, wielding a stack of foil, put in millions. Up until this point, I wasn't the kind of person who would take random investment advice from my hairdresser, talented though he may be in the art of balayage. But since the pandemic, I'd had a creeping sense that the rules no longer applied. The system was rigged and ready to break. Among my friends, it was a running joke. Might as well enjoy ourselves before we're all living in bunkers. That night, I went home and put $7,000, a not insubstantial sum, to a freelance journalist on the cryptocurrency my hairdresser recommended. In just under a month, I nearly doubled my money. The next month, I downloaded a wallet and learned how to track meme coins on DexScreener. I was now closely monitoring a private group chat that Taub invited me to on X, called It's Time to Nut. I began taking investment advice from an amphibian avatar named Fwag Bonner. But I found that trading meme coins wasn't something I could do casually. I'd step away from my laptop for a few moments to take a phone call or run an errand, and find that the $100 or so I'd put on a coin had evaporated. After shaving a few thousand off my initial winnings, I lost my appetite and gave up. I had only tasted a fraction of the pain meme coin losses can incur. The $30,000 that Zara, the crypto trader who lives on the cannabis farm, put into meme coins directly out of her savings grew at its peak to $1.7 million. Then the market nuked, and I kept trading down, she says. I was like, let me just average out here. And then I was left with nothing, with dust. While I only traded meme coins a few short weeks, it permanently scrambled the way I thought about finance and money. For one, it readjusted my appetite for risk. Cryptocurrencies now felt slow, the stock market glacial. Yet the most unexpected development was this. My understanding of money was now completely abstracted. It was numbers on a screen that went up and down. An entire generation has come to think about money this way. To young people, money has always been fake numbers on the internet, a cryptocurrency business founder tells me, and because these numbers are tied to an online economy made up of trivial jokes and crude cartoons, losing it can feel just as surreal as winning. This was true for Vanessa Sierra, a former Love Island Australia contestant, who, after losing $100,000 in a few short days, was left only momentarily speechless. Had it happened with real money, it would have affected me a lot more, she says. If it was in my bank account, I would be crying for days. Everything is a market in some sense, says Austin Adams, the founder of an on-chain markets company called Whetstone Research. If you're not thinking about it as a market, someone else is thinking about it for you. You post on Facebook and Instagram and say this isn't a market, but it is. There's a market being run in the background on an ad exchange that's demanding your attention. We have to admit this is a market and that someone else is extracting that value through something else. It used to be that the value of an investment was tied to its perceived usefulness or performance. But all this changed with the arrival of meme stocks. These stocks typically represented companies that were not particularly useful or promising. But they were valuable for one important reason. People on the internet talked about them a lot. Attention has always been valuable but difficult to price. A blue check on Instagram promises credibility. A large follower count or a virtual moment can open a world of opportunity. Attract as many eyeballs as you like, but there was never any way to cash in on the gaze itself. So it's just the next phase, says Bark, a crypto influencer who, according to a woman who knows him, is running what amounts to a full-blown cult on X. Anything he tells his audience to do, they'll do, she says. You make people money, they'll worship you. Having clout and followers and blue check marks had value, but there was no way you could put a dollar on it, Bart continues. Now, we're putting a dollar on it. This may be why people who spend most of their time making products that live on the internet are drawn to the world of crypto, where even micro-influencers can create tokens tied to their online popularity. One such influencer is a guy called Fluffy, who, when I met him at Meme House LA, gave the impression of an ebullient, larger-than-life Nintendo Mario, dressed in red and white striped overalls and a red cap. Fluffy has his own meme coin, which he says is so stressful because my face is on it. If this coin goes bad, it ruins my whole persona in Web3. When Fluffy starred in a commercial for a crypto company called Bullpen earlier this year, his token's total value increased from $28,000 to $40,000 because, as he puts it, people saw me as the commercial. They saw that I was actually putting in work trying to entertain the world, which correlated to the token getting bought. And that makes me feel good. Next photos, tokens of appreciation. The trading room at Meme House LA. Crypto influencer Fluffy, who has his own meme coin, tends to household chores. There is an annoying problem with the nature of attention, however. It tends to alight on the collective imagination with seemingly capricious randomness. But what if you could control where attention was headed next? This, in the view of Amy Street, a former kindergarten teacher who became a crypto influencer after flipping two NFTs for a combined $18,000, is the current trajectory. I'm not in control of whether or not Elon Musk uses the phrase Doge over and over again, or if Labubus are cool in 2 months, she says. But I do control if I'm going to get a tattoo of an eggplant on my stomach, and if there is money on the line, people are going to do some crazy stuff. Bull runs create hunger for money, and people do crazy things and put up a lot of money. That comment about the eggplant tattoo is something Street picked up from a crypto company she's working with called Dare Market, which has yet to launch. The idea is in the name, a market of dares, where people pay bounties that others cash in on by recording themselves performing crowdsourced challenges. These dares, according to the company's founder, Isla Rose Perfito, a bubbly blonde 29-year-old living in New York, could include things like breaking into a Scientology center, moving into a McDonald's for 24 hours, and getting people to streak at the Super Bowl. The goal, says Perfito, is to break the internet. It's like Black Mirror Jackass coded, but still super relatable. It'll give you the feeling that you can change the world, and the adrenaline rush of driving a fast car. I tell her it all sounds a bit like Squid Game, the TV show about poor people who play deadly children's games in order to win a prize fronted by wealthy spectators. It is, yeah, she says brightly. It's very similar. Stephanie Stuntcheva, a professor of economics at Harvard University, has documented an explosive uptick in the U.S. in zero-sum thinking, what she describes as a mindset that if you or a group of people wins, it must mean that someone else loses. This belief has grown on a drastic scale, especially among young people who experience less upward mobility than previous generations. Today, many people think that their jobs are much worse than their parents, and that good jobs are just not attainable to them, which is driving this idea that their job will not be sufficient to give them an income, she says. I'm just trying to break out of the matrix, man, Vera, a meme coin trader at Meme House LA, tells me. I don't want a 9-to-5 job for the rest of my life. I see so much money in this market being thrown around every day. Why not learn how to reach in and grab some? During the 5 hours that I visited the Meme House LA, the meme coin traders, including Vera, rarely left their desk. There they sat for hours, clicking and clicking away. Sometimes I check in on their live streams, where I watch them performing on-camera challenges, partying on a yacht, and, of course, trading meme coins, chasing the jackpot. The Last Stand. Richard Prince has shocked the cultural establishment again and again with norm-breaking, some say law-breaking, conceptual artworks. But since the pandemic, he's been holed up in his Hamptons home, rarely making appearances. In an unprecedented interview late in his career, he spills to Nate Freeman about the surprising new series he calls Folk Songs and his 6-hour film, Deposition. And for the first time, he discusses what will happen to his estate after he's gone. Opening photograph by Taryn Simon, which shows Prince dressed in a suit lying on a sandy beach. Prince was photographed on the shore of the Atlantic Ocean. In other photos, Dark Arts, Untitled Folk Songs 2022, Richard Prince's new work will be shown for the first time in November at the Gagosian Gallery. It was a Saturday in July, perfect weather in Sagaponack, and Richard Prince walked to the door of his beach house wearing a shirt with one of his hippie drawings. He had on beat-up khakis and sneakers without socks. There was golf on the TV, paintings of flowers and birds and seashells on the walls. Prince has been out east for a while. He got property in this secluded spot in the 90s when he followed his friend Glenn O'Brien to the houses near potato fields. It was pretty empty then, and collectors Don and Mira Rubel had a place nearby so they would all get lunch. Later, Prince spent summers here with his family. Boogie boards and a surfboard his kids used growing up were leaning on the deck, filthy. They didn't get to use them much anyway. The breaks off Wainscot Beach aren't shit, Prince said. He wanted to bring me to the guest house he converted to a studio. I was excited. I'd be maybe the third person to see his first completely new series of work since 2018. It has a great name, like all his best series, Girlfriends, Hoods, Nurses, Cowboys, Jokes. These new works are called folk songs. As he enters his late 70s, Prince is now the greatest living artist depicting the good, the bad, and the ugly of cultural Americana. Not quite half a century ago, he shocked the art world with brazen acts of appropriation, re-photographing the cowboys in Marlboro cigarette ads and blowing the results up into his own art, modifying the source material. Those works now sell for more than $3 million at auction, making them among the most expensive photographs in history. His paintings sell for more. In 2021, Prince's Runaway Nurse, a painting over an inkjet print of a pulp novel on canvas, sold for more than $12 million. As he's gotten older, he's built out the Prince business as a Gemischwerk. There's the art, a books collection that's an artwork in and of itself, the operational body shop churning out trucks, the merch, the weed vape pens, and what's perhaps his grand opus, a town-sized series of buildings as sculptures in a remote part of the Catskills. After a career of constantly breaking the rules, and in the mind of some, the law, Prince's omnivorous eye has become a gold standard for American art. He's a genius, there's no doubt about it, said Larry Gagosian, the world's most prominent art dealer, who's featured Prince solo shows at his global network of galleries 23 times in 20 years. He's one of the great artists of his generation, and maybe the defining cultural artist. I mean, you have to think of an artist like Warhol. That's pretty good company. Over and over, Prince has transformed. After painting jokes on monochromatic canvases, he painted car hoods. He meddled in the legacy of de Kooning, Klein, and Pollock. After his scandalous Instagram portraits, he made High Times, large-scale, colorful paintings celebrating the 1960s. Prince is not that easy to get hold of. Before we chatted, he hadn't given an extended interview in more than a decade. He isn't planning on giving any more after this one. He's had a health scare. Since 2020, he's been mostly at his Hamptons home, doing work in isolation. He isn't a recluse on the level of, say, J.D. Salinger, whose work Prince has appropriated in the past. Prince still has a place in the city, two connected townhouses perched on a desirable east side block dotted with blue-chip galleries. Edward Hopper's chair car hangs over the fireplace in his kitchen. Downstairs is a maybe Pollock with a disputed provenance. There's a piece from Warhol's little-known retrospective series that shows the Pope of Pop in a rare contemplative mode, mashing up his most famous series. Prince and Warhol share a birthday, 21 years apart. The townhouses also have part of his rare books collection, which the book dealer Matt Schuster has called the finest of its kind in the United States. Richard Prince's book collection might be his best work, Schuster said. It's not just source material, it's his worldview, a private club with one member. And he has a few hundred acres upstate, where he's installed vast sculptural works, storage facilities, hangar-sized gallery spaces, and a house shingled with vinyl records and a disco ball once owned by James Brown inside. The Hamptons is a good place to play art world bingo. I had a full dance card that evening. I told Prince that Joe Bradley and Valentina Ackerman were holding a dinner at their Amagansett art space, Gallery Sardine, for new work by Nate Lohman. Prince was intrigued. He's collected Bradley's work and Lohman's. When I later told Lohman and Bradley that Prince said hello, they were slightly agog. You saw him in person? No one had in a while. Apart from shooting 18 holes at the Bridge, one of the world's most expensive golf clubs, he's been mostly up in his studio, working like mad, with no assistants, just painting away. Listen, Richard barely noticed COVID, said Bob Rubin, who founded the Bridge in 2002. I mean, it had the least impact on him. He kind of keeps to himself anyway. Prince has been playing golf since he chased down balls at the Hyannisport Club in the 60s. As a malcontent teenager, he was keeping grounds right next to the Kennedy compound in Hyannis. There was a rumor that even among those willing to spend $1.5 million to join the Bridge, Prince won the club championship one year. He won the senior club championship. Let's not get carried away, Rubin said. Next photo, Contact High. Prince's last series, High Times, including this work, Untitled 2017, got rave reviews and already felt like a coda to a career. A selection of Prince's new work will be shown at Gagosian in November. Even for Prince, who's made a career of departures, it's a departure. It explores mortality, the unknown, and folk art. This idea of making things, but not necessarily calling them art, I do that a lot, he told me, and sometimes what I make remains just the making of it, but sometimes what I make does turn into art. The series began with the gigantic rubber blasting mats he found upstate and installed on his property as just that, not art, just the making of it. One night, he heard the wind going through the rubber, and it made a squeak. A song through the folk art. A folk song. He started making new paintings. He brought in garish motifs, bloody mouths with appropriated cigarettes, inkjet printed onto them, the trail of smoke making an abac swirl hula-hooping through the canvas. Then there's the surfers, the figures hanging tin, also inkjet printed with the ripple of wake painted behind the figures. Some of these paintings are massive. A lot of this work has been in the racks for a couple of years before the train got in, he said. He went off on the train thing and how it relates to the history of the folk movement, something he was on the ground floor of in the 60s. I'm not sure when I thought about the train or looked at the train, but I remember the train being part of the Dust Bowl, Woody Guthrie, the Hobo. There were a bunch of trains. On the Cisco Houston album, there's a train. And whatever is inherent in that name, whatever the name suggests, folk songs, whether it suggests acoustic guitars or protest, that's part of it for me. I wondered, who else has seen this indelibly Princian but radically different new world that will also no doubt make people quite angry? I've shown this to maybe three or four people so far, really, he said. I've shown the folk songs to one other artist, and I did show it to Larry. When asked about the perhaps unexpectedly dark nature of the new works, Gagosian said, I can't wait for the show. I think people are going to really be fascinated by this work, and puzzled by it, and enthralled, and all those things. I can't wait to see it on the wall. When Prince, in 2017, unveiled his previous new series, High Times, it already felt like a coda to a career. In a rave, the New York Times praised it as one of his best. This coda to the coda will kick off an enormously busy 12 months for any artist, but especially one approaching his late 70s. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval Selections by Mark Hoffman.